This is Michael. You're listening to Models of Masters, and I'm so grateful you're here. I'm breaking down personal stories, learned wisdom, and pieces of insight I hope can help you along your journey. Head over to my website, michaelbecker.org, for much more. And with that, let's get right into the show. Welcome back to another episode, guys. My guest today operates at the intersection of neuroscience, behavioral science, technology, and team leadership. He's held executive roles at companies like Kodak and HP, and now runs his own consultancy where he uses proprietary neuroscience-based software to measure how leader behavior impacts team performance. He's also a four-time startup founder and CEO. And today he consults CEOs and leaders on maximizing their efficiency, eliminating toxicity in the workforce, and creating a more trusting workforce and team that ripples throughout the enterprise. He's the author of two books, The One Habit and Team Relationship Management. I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Jeb Hurley.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much for sitting down.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So there's so much to dive into, you know, on all of these topics. We're immersed right now in what feels like a revolution in terms of culture and work. And I want to dig into all of that. But where I'd love to start is really just on what's brought you to where you are now, and specifically, you know, the things that you learned throughout your career with the companies you've been at, Kodak, HP, and others, that helped you identify the need in the market. And then not just that behavioral science could be something helpful for teams, but could potentially be the antidote to inspiring better leaders in companies.
Cool. Yeah, great question. And yeah, it's something I can geek out like all day on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, the Genesis story, yeah, talking about me is probably not my favorite topic, so we can get through this one quick. But it is interesting how our early experiences, you know, particularly our life's journey, you know, as children and as we come into adulthood, but then as we begin our careers,
yeah.
I found that I was really sensitive to kind of bad managers, you know, mm-hmm. toxicity in environments. And in a way that, you know, I found that it had a pretty profound effect on sort of my view of what it meant to be part of an organization.
Right.
And that happened sort of early in my career. And then I had the good fortune of being part of some great teams and some great organizations. And so you get this kind of contrast that was the sort of the primordial soup out of which, you know, this intense curiosity about the why of that.
Yeah.
And as I had the good fortune during my early career to have been sponsored by organizations like Digital Equipment and Kodak, they did some pretty awesome leadership development programs.
Yeah.
The Center for Creative Leadership at Harvard Business School, later on at the Aspen Institute, their Leadership at the Peak. And two things struck me with that. One, you know, if you have an organization that's willing to invest in you as a young executive,
mm-hmm.
it makes a difference. But yet I still couldn't answer the question for others, sort of, you know, why one organization, why one team, you know, why one division was so effective and the others weren't.
Right.
Because it was very much a personal journey as opposed to a collective.
Mm.
And that's what triggered my interest in that ultimately led to my kind of doing the deep dive, earning a doctorate in organizational leadership with a focus in the behavioral science and team dynamics.
Yes.
Was trying to get a sense of the broader patterns, because sort of, you know, the reality is, even if you've had half a dozen or more roles, you still don't have statistical validity. You have a point of view that's come from your experiences, but you don't have the benefit of that broader, deeper look.
Yes.
And so that became my kind of my why, was to be able to answer for others that question, to stay relevant.
Yep.
As I moved through a career that has had both, as you mentioned, large corporate experiences at the kind of corporate VP general manager level, as well as multiple CEO experiences in early stage and growth stage companies. And my goal became, you know, my mission for myself became one of gathering insights that I could then take to others and make a difference in their lives and the lives of the people that were part of their organization.
Bridging the gap, so to speak,
exactly.
Between what people don't know but need to know about what drives behavior, and then existing dynamics that perhaps have been in place far too long.
In yeah, a lot of yeah exactly. And as you said at the outset, you know, in a world that is going through, you know, really dramatic and rapid change,
yeah.
And you know, the workplace, you know, of our parents and their parents, is not the world that we're operating mm-hmm. in today. In fact, you know, most managers, if they're over 30, 35 years old, grew up in an environment where today's world is pretty foreign.
Yes.
Both, you know, driven by sort of multiple factors, changes in the way organizations are designed, changes mm-hmm. in the population of those organizations, mm-hmm. particularly sort of the millennial Gen Z, or, you know, taking now a much bigger part in the decision making and the operations of organizations.
Yes.
And, you know, the political climate. I mean, sort of all of these dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Intersecting at once creates some real challenges for today's yes. aspiring managers and leaders.
Yeah. I can relate. I mean, and to so much of your journey as well. You know, I share a lot of those, a lot of parallels. I'm still in the first, you know, third of my career. I just turned 31. So, you know, really, really still in a spot of figuring out not just what I want, but how to adapt and adjust to an obviously different environment from where I began 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been with really large companies, with multinational, you know, well-funded, you know, established SaaS companies, to startups that were local. And we were just trying to be scrappy and figure out what yeah. worked. And the leadership style, you know, is to be expected, very different between both of those dynamics, and then you have everything in between. But something that struck me about what you were talking about, I think a metaphor that feels interesting for me to look at companies is that of an ocean. And then it's like you have smaller ponds of teams within the organization. And if there's no tributaries between those different ponds, then they're really just almost like separate, they're siloed within the company. And so I'm curious what some examples may be where you've seen that disconnect within companies, and then how, especially in this remote culture, like what steps can teams and companies take to make sure that cohesion doesn't get lost?
Yeah, good question and observation. I think that you know, if you go back in time, mm-hmm. and one of the products of the Industrial Revolution
yeah.
was the form of the corporation
yep.
That was incredibly effective
yeah.
at kind of building things in mass production and getting them out the door.
Yeah.
And the very nature of those organizations were hierarchical, right? You had a hierarchy that was driven by more of kind of command and control. And there were lots of guardrails. And that produced silos, which is why, you know, sort of most large legacy organizations have a more, you know, sort of hierarchical siloed structure.
Yes.
And they depended on a lot of processes being put in place for communications, for managing decisions up and down. And in a relatively slow moving world where you could, you know, your strategic plans were a 5-year or 10-year exercise, it worked. And, you know, it was really, you know, as we came into particularly the latter part of the 20th century into the 21st century,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, as the pace of technological change in particular began to take hold, right?
Yeah.
You could trace it back to the internet, and then sort of these trends around process reengineering and re-looking at sort of the structure and design of corporations, all of a sudden, you know, and the removal of middle management, which mm-hmm. was kind of the glue in a lot of these big companies that,
yeah.
that held that together.
Yeah.
And the shift to more of a more team-based organization suddenly removed the guardrails.
Yes.
And this is one of the dimensions of that that people don't realize or think about, is that the need in the traditional corporate structure, the need for trust was actually relatively low.
Yeah.
Because you had all of these checks and balances mm. at every level. And
yes.
it's not that things didn't go wrong and go sideways. So, you know, of course they did. People are people. But there was a lot of, in the structure, in the silos, a lot of sort of risk reduction that happened. When you move to something that is flatter, more team-based, more independent, mm-hmm. then the trust becomes something that is far more important.
Yeah.
As just a, not just a core value in an organization, but as a set of, as a behavior that has to permeate it. Otherwise, without all of those traditional guardrails, it kind of goes off. It's easy. And we've seen tons of examples of that in, companies that grew fast, like an Uber and other organizations that moved, that shifted their model and suddenly found themselves sideways when it came to the behaviors and the values and the norms of that organization and, moving down into things which were, if not illegal, certainly somewhat, unethical.
Sure.
Whether it was, sexual harassment or racism or, just any of those toxic behaviors become easier to ferment inside of an organization, in today's organizations that are flatter, more fluid, more agile.
True.
So, and you asked about how do you deal with that? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you look at the organizations that have handled that the very, very best, where teams are exceptionally good at maintaining the level of trust and psychological safety, it's people's comfort, being able to be themselves, bring their whole selves to the team, to the organization, right, at a group level as opposed to just an individual level, they all share a common denominator around the type of culture they build in organizations.
Yes.
And the big challenge and the big unknown for, for so many organizations, so many leaders, is the how of that.
Right.
So, the answer is simple. You build a great culture around trust, around performance, psychological safety, and relationships.
Yes. Yes.
And you break down, you rapidly will remove silo-like behavior. You engender sort of collaboration,
camaraderie,
innovation, and camaraderie
in
ways that, teams and the organization they're part of will excel. But it's a lot easier said than done.
I think that these concepts of camaraderie and community within organizations and the importance of feeling comfortable and having emotional intelligence from a top-down, perspective within organizations, it's not new, but it's relatively new in terms of how people look at the importance of, injecting a certain level of comfort and trust in especially modern remote cultures and tech companies. I don't think people like JP Morgan or Henry Ford were very worried about the how pleased and happy and emotionally safe that their employees felt, right? Their main goal was to put processes in place that could optimize productivity and therefore revenue for the company. But we don't live in that world anymore. Talk about the added layers of complexity that have come along with, the way that things have evolved today.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Michael. And the interesting thing is, there was, starting in the middle of after World War II, the middle of the 20th century, and it accelerated this, and into the positive psychology and sort of really understanding that, that people and employees who had their basic needs met tended to be better employees. They tended,
right.
So there sort of was that realization, but again, it was happening initially within these more siloed hierarchical organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if trust isn't something that a manager or a leader needs to, they're not worrying about it, at least in a really conscious way. They'll do other things, employee, support programs, employee assistance programs. A lot of good things happen through that. And I was fortunate to be part of organizations, large organizations that they put a lot of those kinds of supportive programs in place.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't, what that doesn't take care of is when you move to a different organizational design, that team of teams that get built out. One of the biggest ahas in my work and research was that the complexity that's introduced by that is very much a function of, you have more human behaviors coming to the fore.
Yeah.
Whereas, if you're in a role inside of a silo that's pretty plug compatible with most other roles, and no matter sort of what you're told, all the way up to the CEO, that's if it's not working out, you leave. They ask you to leave. They put somebody else in.
Yeah.
As you move into sort of these flatter organizations, individual behaviors become much more amplified and more, even more. So is team behavior. And my aha was that ultimately culture, you know, it's not something that somebody pronounces. Organizational culture, it's not something you manage.
Right.
You know, it's really team behavior that's happening at scale, like an invisible hand. Or you can, you know, for Star Wars fans, they can think of it as kind of like the Force.
Yeah.
Where it's this force that is influencing people's behavior. It's influencing how they live, the values and the norms that is part of their team and other teams in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about that is that once you recognize that, you know, culture is team, and especially executive team behavior, scaled.
Yeah.
Then you can begin to reduce things down into the human dynamics that are shared by everybody. And that turns out to be the key.
Okay.
That so much of what gets focused on inside of, you know, whether, you know, your leadership, you know, leadership development and training is, number one, the individual versus the team. And then when it's even if it is the team, it's not really focusing on the behavioral dynamics that are driving the culture of that team. And to really get at that, you got to dig a little deeper.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where, you know, my interest in my work, as you described at the beginning, around starting with, you know, what are those core drivers that make us human, that get on display when we become part of a group, you know, that is intended to become a team, to work together to accomplish something. And it's that sort of basic neurobiology that then intersects with, you know, the, you know, our personalities and who we've become, that intersects with this all these other humans, that becomes a really interesting place to influence as a leader in an organization. Because when you get that right, you've decoded culture.
Definitely.
Yeah. And you're not managing it, you're not controlling it. You decoded it so that
like
you can influence it
I like
in ways that, you know, attract talent.
Yes.
People who
and keep
want
it.
To be there and keep it. That's exactly right.
Well, and one thing that's been on my mind a lot lately is, and I want to get your thoughts on this too, things that inspire and that trigger employees to actually want to engage and remain and be creative and add value and, you know, actually move the needle. As opposed to being disengaged and, you know, nonchalant or lackadaisical in their approach. And I think that's also been an interesting moving target with, you know, the remote world that we've moved into. Maybe this is a separate question, but I'm going to forget it if I don't say
sure.
it, because it's very fascinating to me as a millennial. And so I'm going to say a blanket statement here that's probably not true for everybody, but in general, I think that the way that millennials tend to want to work and the way that we tend to be incentivized is different from the way that my parents' generation or the baby boomers grew up. And I think there is an unspoken divide there as more, you know, 20 and 30 year old, as that cohort starts to come in to positions of, you know, more authority and leadership in companies, the things that we care about, they're very different from past generations. Flexibility, I mean, salary is important, but maybe not as important as cohesiveness of the team and freedom to work when, where, and how we want. Like, how is that? How do you even go about bridging that gap?
Yeah, no, that's a great observation that has some real truth in it.
Yeah.
But let me kind of reframe it a little
please.
Bit. Because, and I'm going to reframe it from not a generational perspective, but from a cultural perspective in the national culture sense.
Yeah.
One of my big learnings in working, part of what I did when I was at HP is I had the privilege of working with some really talented country leaders and teams across Asia.
Okay.
You can't get any more different than how a leader in India is approaching his or her team and sort of building a high performance, high trust team versus Japan, versus Vietnam, versus Australia.
Mm.
And so it was an interesting challenge because, you know, as this sort of Western, you know, American, you know, it would have been incredibly, both naive and as well as hubris to think that I was going to go in and tell someone like that or help someone like that be a better manager in that country.
Yeah.
But what I realized is that what I could do is if I found what sat beneath culture that was common to everybody as a human being.
Right.
If you can get that right,
right,
then you can adjust it for national culture. You can also adjust it for generational cultures. So you're absolutely right about the, you know, from a Gen Z, from a millennial, from, you know, up through baby boomers. But the difference is, it's not like, you know, Gen Z, you know, although, you know, every generation, so, you know, so, you know, the parents, you know, complain about the kids and they're this, you know, I mean, every, right, it's been forever.
Yeah.
But in reality, of course, as humans, you know, from a, you know, from a neuropsychological level, you know, it's not like we've evolved very much in the last few millennia or more. So fundamentally, we all have the same needs and drives as human beings, because this is wired into our brains.
Okay.
It manifests differently.
Yeah.
Because if you grew up in the post-World War II baby boom generation, your socialization as an employee, as a person, was heavily influenced by the events that shaped the world at that time.
Very much so.
And so, you know, our parents, grandparents, you know, it was, or, you know, if you go back, like, grandparent generation, right, they dealt with the Depression.
Yeah.
Much as millennials, you guys dealt with the 2008 financial crisis. All of that stuff influences the way we think about, you know, job security and pay and all of those things.
Yeah.
What it doesn't change is those fundamental needs around having a set of aligning the core, the values that you hold close as a person with the values of a team and of an organization.
Okay.
What that doesn't change is that you want to find purpose and meaning in your work and develop the skills to be able to do that and have the freedom.
Right.
Everybody has that same core set of psychological needs when it comes to work. Everybody wants to find meaning and purpose in what they do, build the skills to realize that purpose, and be given the freedom to go after it. So whether I'm managing a team of Gen Zs, baby boomers, millennials, or all three, if my conversation with you as a manager, as a leader, is about helping you find that purpose in your role, building the skills and giving you the freedom, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that turns out to be the key. And this is where behavioral science and the neuroscience that supports it becomes so powerful. Because what I'm doing is I'm tapping into part of it's actually your limbic system and related processes, where, you know, when we have that conversation, you walk away literally with I've triggered a dopamine release.
Yes.
You feel good. You go home, you know, high at night, talk to, you know, your significant other, spouse, and say, wow, you know, I had a great conversation with my boss today, and, you know, we talked about sort of how I can continue to build in my role and supporting me to get to do that.
Yes.
And man, he lets, you know, as I get this stuff, he just lets me run with it. So everybody needs that.
Right. Right.
So that turns out to be this really cool, sits below age divisions, cultural divisions.
Got it.
That when leaders get that, when they grasp how to the understanding and how to influence, that's how you build high trust, high performance cultures by influencing the you know, and meeting the core needs of everybody on your team or everybody in the organization.
And I want to ask you about the architecture of habit formation as well, and specific tactics that either individuals or managers and team leaders can use to catalyze and trigger the desires and the feel-good chemicals that you were just alluding to. And it's different for everybody. The things that would incentivize me to feel like I wanted to work harder and, or not harder, but more productive or to have an impact, may be very different from somebody else. I like to see the impact of my work, for example, on other people, either internally, but especially externally. I like to have that validation to know that what I'm doing is making a difference in the world. And when I see the effect of that, it gets me excited. It arouses me to want to produce more and do better. Take that where you want.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why it's so powerful when, you know, and again, you know, kind of going back to this refrain, you know, culture is team behavior at scale, right? Because it's the team level, the team construct that is having the biggest impact on individuals and the organization, you know, and the culture of the organization, because that's a, you know, that's a, say, a six-person unit. I, as, you know, as a team member of that, you know, and particularly, you know, in a, if I strive to be a servant, you know, kind of a servant leader, someone whose my job is to help Michael, you be successful. Mm. That's why I exist in this role.
Love that concept.
Then by helping you find that purpose,
yeah,
yours, versus your colleague here and your colleague here, you guys are all different. But in the context of what it is we're looking to accomplish as a team,
yeah,
then I have taken that first step in creating, you know, a cultural environment where people will really thrive.
Yes.
Now, to get to your question, we as humans, we are incredibly good at screwing that up. You know, it's just, you know, the very nature of human nature is we, you know, because, right, we're talking about relationships, mm-hmm. and we're really pretty good at messing up relationships. But what is the, if you boil that down into its essence, and this becomes kind of the third big piece, it boils down to a very simple dynamic that is also happens to be also the kind of the core of what is trust, which is simply, you know, trust in its simplest definition is that is we trust when we have a positive expectation that we can be vulnerable with another person and that our experience will be positive in that encounter. Mm. That's simple. So every relationship we have is built around this notion that we have an expectation.
Yeah.
Parents, yeah. Siblings, girlfriends, whatever.
Yes.
We have an expectation, our bosses, you know, at work, it's our bosses, our colleagues, and other people on other teams. The experience those people deliver is what's going to determine, the size of the gap is going to determine that level of toxicity, mm. that, you know, depending on the why, but also the direction of that relationship. Right? If we have a high expectation of someone and they consistently disappoint, what happens? How do you feel about it?
Your expectations plummet.
And then what happens to that? What happens to your expectation of that relationship?
Yeah, nothing.
You give up.
Yeah,
right.
Nothing.
So
nothing there.
You know, there's nothing there. That's exactly right. So the key then is being able to. It's sort of developing, yeah, it's part of emotional intelligence, part of sort of EQ, but developing
sure.
this radar-like sense of where are the gaps on my team between what people are expecting of me, the manager,
right.
of each other as teammates, and perhaps on, you know, other teams they depend on.
Yeah.
And it's then becomes my ability, and so simple, if I get good at closing those gaps, changing people's behavior mm-hmm. to close those gaps, then I have created this virtuous habit cycle. It's, mm. it's why my first book was called The One Habit.
Yeah.
And it came out of this, you know, and it came out of some, I had the good fortune and privilege of working with an Israeli Air Force squadron during my research and studying a number of SEAL teams. And one night at dinner with the fighter pilots, when we were talking sort of generally about, their, you know, how they go operational, and mm-hmm. you know, and that captain, he was pretty funny. He said, "Look, we probably have the biggest egos in Israel." Serious. He said, "I mean, because they're the 1% of the 1%. They're probably some of the best, if not the best, fighter pilots in the world."
Yeah,
and you know, they know it, right? He said, "But there's when we go into the operations room, there's not an ego allowed in that room."
Right.
And he said, "If there's a gap between what we expect of each other on this team, if anybody said." We will not fly with someone if we don't have that gap closed," mm. he said. "Because mm. we're at 1.5-2 times you know Mach speeds, and you know flying wing to wing, and sometimes the communications is it's looking and literally it's cockpit to cockpit.
Yeah.
You can't trust that.
Yeah,
absolutely, because there's no gap between what you expect of your colleague and the experience they're about to deliver as." You know, as you go into an operation, somebody doesn't come home. Mm. So super high stakes,
right.
to close the gaps. But it was that aha, because we can all do that.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
can all get good at seeing if there, you know, is there a gap between what you expect of me as your manager? Why is that gap there? Mm. And then if I work to close it, that's the one habit. Because what I've done is I have triggered some of the most powerful, I've done two things. I've triggered some of the most powerful brain chemistry around building trust in our relationship
yeah.
and safety on that team.
Yeah.
And I've also diminished the likelihood of triggering the much more dangerous neurochemicals that are that a company, when trust is lost. Because when we diminish trust, if we destroy trust, you know, people don't forget, you know, people really don't forget that.
Yes.
You know, you can build trust and people like it.
Yeah.
You destroy trust and people hate you.
I wanted to ask you about that point. I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah.
So many people talk about or regurgitate information that they've heard about the value and the importance of positivity in the workplace. But I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about the compounding negative impact of toxicity in the workplace. And I know you felt it at times in your career. I know I've certainly felt it in my career as well. And I think from my perspective, a lot of the toxicity that tends to evolve in the workplace, especially, and then mutate unto itself, right, which really just makes things all that much more worse. But I think I do think it starts with ego and just a level of selfishness with wanting to propel one's own agenda or career, perhaps at the expense of a team or others or even the organization. I think at a base level, you know, to some degree, we're all self-serving, especially from a career perspective. That's what we're looking to do. So number one, like, how do you put the needs of the group or the company above yourself? Number two, is that a realistic goal or expectation to have? And then how do you reduce toxicity from mutating within a group or team?
Which is really can be one of the most challenging aspects of group dynamics, right?
When, yeah,
it's because it's like cancer metastasizing.
Exactly.
Body.
Exactly.
But I think that, so kind of to break that apart a little bit. So there's no, you know, you have multiple things going on. You have the behaviors which will, you know, trigger distrust, you know, or the destruction of trust. And, you know, and they range from, you know, malignant narcissism and, you know, and pathologies where, you know, I mean, people really, they're just there for themselves. I mean, you can describe them accurately. It's important to understand that what's happening when that happens is, you know, people go through, you're triggering a very different, you're triggering a much older part of the brain. And systems that trigger some very strong emotions, as well as stress chemicals. This is what you literally feel it when that goes right. You really do it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, literally, it can make people mentally and physically ill. And you know, and it's why we then, you know, you go through a lot of rationalizing and shielding, or whatever, to try and protect ourselves in toxic situations.
Yeah.
The defense against that. I mean, it all starts with building, you know, if it's young companies and even companies as they grow, you know, and this is why I focus on executive teams and CEO, because they are modeling the behaviors that are going to then influence the culture for the rest of the organization.
Sure.
If you put the bar extremely high, like the Israeli fighter pilots do, like the Navy SEALs do, like, you know, really good hospital OR teams, and you can find it everywhere.
Yeah.
What they all share is they've set the bar very high around the values that the individual brings to the team and the behaviors they live in supporting those values.
Okay.
And they set and with a very low tolerance for any deviation away from those core values and the behaviors associated with them. Because they know that at the end of the day, that is what's going to determine how everyone else experiences you know, their work at that or on that team or in that organization. So the key by far is, you know, that's where you start. Fixing it goes back to actually what I was just describing, is that when I'm asked to come into an organization to do some detoxing work, it's a pretty, you know, it's like being a neurosurgeon, right? I mean, the first thing you do is diagnose. You know, where are the sources? You know, where's the cancer? You know, and it's almost always behavioral. Isolate that, and then one of two things. So, you know, either you're going to remove it, or you're going to treat it. And the treatment is, it's this sort of consistently closing the experience expectation gap against a set of values and norms that reflect the culture you want to build.
Right.
So if I want a high trust, high performance culture, you know, that you know, people are energized by, you know, and it doesn't mean everybody's like always just like nice to each other. You know, it's not about that, because learning how to create constructive conflict is crucial to innovation. Mm. That ability to, you and I can, you know, go at it and argue, but we're doing it, it's not personal. We're doing it to arrive at a better decision.
Right.
So building, you know, all those are values that, you know, different organizations have different sets of, different teams will have different subcultures and values.
Yeah.
The key is, though, to detoxifying, when you're going to detoxify, you diagnose, you isolate, you treat, or you do surgery. That's really kind of it. And or it kills, and it kills teams, it kills organizations. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, kind of the, one of the, you know, top causes of organizational and team death is toxic culture.
And that's where you start to I was going to say that I think that's where you start to see, you know, more turnover, higher turnover rates by the years. The company looks nothing like it did 1 year prior, and it may spread, you know, among everybody, or even worse, to customers and clients.
Yeah.
And it could be the downfall of
an organization. I will tell you, and what's even worse, and because there's a lot more of it, is that organizations, they just get mired in mediocrity. You know, it's not so bad that they die.
Yeah.
It's why, you know, in most industry sectors, you know, it's a bell curve, distribution. You have some really bad performers, and they're on their deathbed. They're the walking dead.
Yeah.
You have these top performers in the industry, in any given industry sector, and they just are knocking it out of the park. And then you have kind of everybody in the middle who's trying to figure it out, and you know, they're just average, you know. And they may have some stars here, but at the end of the day, and sometimes, you know, they're kind of like the, the 1990 Olympic, what was it, the Olympic basketball team with, you know, that had Jordan, had Charles Barkley, they had everybody. And they got beat by, you know, they got beat in a practice game by, you know, a college squad.
Yeah.
Because they didn't play as a team.
Yeah.
So you can have organizations that are made up of stars, but if it generates a toxic culture, they are going to underperform, you know, a group of far less talented individuals who understand how to come together and just operate flawlessly as a team.
I want to dig into that as we kind of approach the natural culmination of this conversation. I think there's a lot of nuance to this and to instilling a dynamic within your teams and within your company cultures that is productive and that ultimately will bleed through every level, every function, every part of your team. Can you give one or two examples of tactics that you've seen implemented in the companies you've been a part of or worked for, either positively or negatively?
In terms of it, give me a little bit more of that.
Specific strategies or things that the leaders in these companies have either done or that has clearly been, you know, a source of toxicity or downfall within the organization.
Oh, yeah. Let me go the other way, because toxic's easy, right? I mean, that's, I'll give some examples to where it breaks down. But I think that if we were to characterize, sort of, you know, what do the very best CEOs and executive teams do?
Right.
You know, it's not, you know, I mean, there's a lot that goes with that chair, the CEO's chair in particular.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's really your ability as a CEO to come in and have a compelling vision for where you want to go, and a very clear strategy of how you're going to get there, and how you're going to allocate resources.
Okay.
And this is a team sport, right? Particularly in today's world, this is not somebody sitting on high. This is that servant leader model where I'm working with my executive team to, you know, with input from lots of stakeholders around this vision, the strategy, and the resources we're going to deploy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, your ability to take that and sort of, you begin to sort of operationalize it, and you do that through culture.
Mm-hmm.
You do that through organizational design. Mm. You do that through the metrics that you put in place. So there's, you know, there's these, and I won't go sort of through them all, although, so there's that piece, and then there's sort of how do you mobilize and motivate people?
Right.
I talked about that earlier, right? You need to connect the dots between that vision, that strategy, the metric, and then how you're going to measure performance in that to what people want as individuals. And so that's pushing that down, and that's where trust, psychological safety, and relationships, you keep those as your North Star, as part of your culture. You build the rest around it, and then the key, and this is perhaps one of the non-obvious, is if you're in the CEO chair, the other thing you need to absolutely do is focus on your own personal self-development mm-hmm. and well-being.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you lose that, the rest of it begins to crumble. And this is where toxic behaviors begin to creep in.
Yes.
Is that, you know, if you're not constantly focused on being kind of the best in your world and taking care of yourself, you're going to start to get creep in values. People are going to start doing things, and they as it moves down into and you're not really enforcing living that.
Right.
And so toxicity, I mean, it's so biological, right? It's just, you know, it can come from some external source that it gets injected into the world. You hire somebody who's toxic, and you don't, as a CEO or as an exec part of an executive team, you don't immediately deal with it. You don't use the fact that, you know, if you don't live the values, you know,
you're not here.
You're not part of this team. It's what organizations like the SEALs do so well,
right?
Because they know that, you know, there's a lot of people have a variety of motivations to want to wear that trident. Mm-hmm. And the friends of mine who've gone through the SEALs program, they say that, you know, you'll see people being eliminated not because they aren't phenomenal athletes, they're really smart, they're there for the wrong reason. They're there for ego, they're there for themselves, they're not there for the team.
And it comes through.
No one wants to walk into that building, you know, under fire with somebody they can't trust.
Yeah.
So you're not going to make it in the best of the best teams, but we can all do that. Mm-hmm. You know, we can all set the bar high for ethical behavior, for those core values, and then live them every day.
Right.
It doesn't cost you anything more to live high, you know, a set of values that result in this high trust, high performance culture and organization. That's the irony of it, is that when you look at mediocrity, you know, that human beings involved versus the highest performance, they're human beings.
Yeah.
They have the same, you know, same stuff going on inside of their brains. So, you know, often they went to the same schools, and yet, you know, that invisible hand that's dictating how people behave is letting this group down versus elevating this other one. Mm. And that's, you know, so toxicity, you know, it creeps in. And once it does, you know, it becomes perhaps the most dangerous
100%.
Dimension of a organization is a culture that's becoming toxic.
So staying adamantly focused on making sure you're bringing the right people in, that you share at a core level, you know, a set of values and beliefs with those people, and then continuing to cultivate a culture of progress and trust and truth and, you know, innovation to move forward.
Yeah, you live them every day. And then, and then going back to the one habit, you recognize that people are human.
Yeah.
They are going to mess it up.
Yeah.
So what you get, as again, going back to the Israeli fighter pilots, what the captain said to me in the end, he said, look, we are not perfect human beings. We're like everybody else, right? We get it wrong. We screw it up. He said, but what we are extraordinarily good at is closing the gaps. Mm-hmm. We're really good at making sure that whatever it was, we own it.
Yeah.
No questions asked. This was my issue. Here's the problem. Here's the solution.
Radical accountability.
It is radical. Not yet. Exactly. As opposed to radical candor, which, you know, if you're an introvert, it completely freaks you out. And, you know, I mean, things like that, you know, these things that sort of become cliches are, but radical accountability and, you know, that willingness to own my own behavior and to be held to a standard, you know, within an organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it's not you, don't be part of this organization. That's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, cool, you know, you don't want to be that, no problem. You're just not going to do it here. And, you know, if more organizations, more CEOs and executive teams took that approach, they would find that their lives would get a lot easier, a lot simpler, and the results would be a lot better.
Dr. Hurley, where can people go to get your book and to connect with you?
Best place to connect with me, LinkedIn, just /... Jeff Hurley. And there's links actually on there to Brainware Partners. And in there, there's all the resources, books and things like that. Anyone, you know, who's so inclined, lots of articles and things that I've written. But again,
wonderful.
You know, it's when you get down to the core of who we are as people and make this really human, it gets a lot simpler as leaders.
Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you got a ton of value with this episode. Big thanks to my guest, Dr. Jeb Hurley. We will include those links right below in the description, so be sure to check those out. And thank you so much for your time.
Michael, my pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey guys, that's it for this episode. Please be sure to rate, review, comment, and share. Everything helps. That is it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. My book, Content Capitalist, is now on sale. You can visit my website, michaelbecker.org, to grab your copy. There's also a link in the description. And if you'd like to learn more about what me and my team at Neocore are building, you can visit our website, neocore.co. You can learn more there and join the waitlist for when we launch later this year.